number three, our interview with Mr. Vernon Jordan, Atlanta, Georgia, March 17. You were talking about Richard Wright and his disillusion with Africa as being, as belonging to a certain star at the moment. How was that?
Yeah, well, I think that the bitterness and the rejection that Mr. Wright expresses must be weighed as against the time that it was written. I'm not certain that if Mr. Wright were writing in 1964 that he would have expressed the same sentiments. As you've just indicated, that the generations change as much as 5 years. 5 years, the time span, can cause great changes. I experienced this myself to some degree. I finished college in 1957. In 1960, the sit-ins broke out. In 1957, 55, 56, 57, I was going 40 miles to get my hair cut. And maybe rather than do that, I should have done what the sit-ins did in 1960. But
week in Indiana, or Illinois, I forget which.
That's right. Now, my problem is I was of a different generation. Between 57 and 60, things had built up to such an intensity that now you have Negroes demonstrating. Now, I also feel certain that if I had been a student in 1960, a college student, that I too would have been involved. That I would have been amongst the first group for my particular school.
Let me ask you something. Reading the papers the other day, I discovered the sit-in demonstrators and other demonstrators, this barbershop somewhere over the Ohio River, were mostly white college students. Would any white college students in DePaul 7 years ago have demonstrated on this matter of your haircut?
Absolutely not. I think that there were those when I was there who were concerned, who thought it was a pretty terrible idea, but at the times that their hair was long, that they needed the crew cut to go to the dance or to take their favorite girl out, that this was not an issue. The issue was whether or not how fast I can get a haircut. There was, however, a professor, Dr. Carell, physics department, who very quietly, without any fanfare, had his wife to cut his hair, and he cut his boy's hair. And this was, in a sense, a silent protest against the situation in Greencastle, that he never communicated publicly to students or to Negroes on the campus.
Well, now what's happened? This is not many years, only 6 or 7 years. What's happened? Now you have hundreds of college students demonstrating in front of a barbershop in some town in Ohio or Indiana, I forget which town it is, about the fact of segregated haircuts.
Yeah.
Well, what's happened now?
Well, I think number one, the ridiculousness of it has been dramatized.
How is it dramatized?
Well, I think that the sit-ins beginning February 1st, 1960, when four boys sit in Greensboro, North Carolina, and for the first time, white people begin to think that here are Negroes whose money is green, who pays the same price for the bar of soap in the 10-cent store, the ribbons for the little girl's hair, for the comb, or what have you, that here they are spending the same amount of money for the same articles, and merely because of the intensity of the blackness in their skin, they cannot sit down to eat a hot dog. Rather, I think the ridiculousness of it was dramatized with the beginning of the sit-ins, and if you really think about it, I think that many white people in the South, and certainly in the North, after the sit-ins, began to think just how ridiculous it is.
Well, now, a long time ago in the 80s, the Charleston newspaper, I forget the name of the paper, said the same thing about the possibility of segregation. This nonsense goes on, this paper said. We'll even have two Bibles to kiss in court or two wedding rooms in railroad stations. This is all very recent, this sort of segregation. It's not an old story. It's not a new story. It's a 75-year-old story.
Well, because I'm not so sure that the Charleston paper was not right. If things had continued
on. They couldn't believe it was going to happen. The segregation was going to happen. Our version of segregation. The modern Southern version of segregation. They couldn't believe it was going to happen. It's too preposterous to believe, they said. But it happened in 5 years after this editorial was written.
Well, and I think that what has happened since 1960 is some sort of realization of the prophecy of the Charleston paper in the 80s.
That's right.
Sure.
This is a very funny thing, though, how you have two generations can condition a whole social system with a minority doing the conditioning. Nobody in the Civil War generation could conceive of modern segregation. Now, they had their vices, but that wasn't one of their vices.
Well, maybe the real tragedy stems from the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1876, when the deal was that federal troops would withdraw, and here they left.
Well, now, let's go to that. That's an interesting question. What would have been a decent, reasonable, and far-reaching reconstruction? Let's assume we start in 1865 and forget Lincoln's death one way or the other. Say, just suppose good and wise men had run the reconstruction. What could have been done?
Well, that's hard to say.
But there are some theories about it.
Well, number one, I guess I must profess some ignorance as to the theories. Certainly, I forget exactly what Lincoln's theory was, but I get some notion that it wasn't quite adequate, and certainly Johnson was totally incompetent to deal with the situation.
Andrew
Lincoln
Johnson would have been impeached probably within a year.
That's right. I also think that probably Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens are to some extent alienated many of the moderate people by their very radical positions. But I think you have to take note of the fact that their radical positions culminated in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. I would hesitate to speculate on what the proper course of Reconstruction would have been. I'm not certain that the Negroes getting extraordinary positions in government, though incompetent, was the answer.
Certainly. Let me read you what Myrdal said would have been the reasonable, though impossible, Reconstruction policy.
All right.
One, federal remuneration for all slaves after the war. Pay for the emancipated, pay the property value at some, price for all emancipated slaves. Mid-off deal. So that's one. Two, expropriation of plantation lands are parts necessary, but full federal payment for land. Southern planter, the Confederate planter. Three, distribution of land to any who needed it, Negro or white, on a long-range mortgage basis, not a gift, but a very long-range mortgage basis.
Common FHA loan.
Yeah, very, very indefinite thing, but carried by society. But a payment required. So there's not a gift, payment required. Like my 20-year mortgage.
Four. I have a 30-year mortgage.
I've got 20 years. Yeah. And I've been robbed.
Yeah. No, you just paid more down, you see.
But four, supervision of freedmen and property plus vocational training and other training as, some sort of skill, that. 5, national taxation to pay costs. Think of that being done. 6, encouragement of Negroes for migration to the West. There is vast amount of free land, federal land, which is being given away to railroads. That was mighty fine land. Billions of dollars were taken off that land. With some kind of, not just sold to the far West, building communities. And so forth. You see the respect that line. Just offhand, emotionally, how would you respond to such a...
Well, I tell you, the first one, that of compensating the slaveholders for their slaves, I think, is sort of an indirect sanction to pay them after emancipation for those persons whom they held enslaved.
This is one of the several things I'm getting at now. You feel an immediate moral revulsion, an emotional revulsion of that idea.
Oh, yes.
That this learned Swede proposes.
I think you're saying to him that this was really right, but you lost the war, but we'll pay you for this. I'm not sure that you can compensate a man for doing something that is legally and morally and by all standards
wrong. Not legally.
Well, legally it was not.
No,
you're not legally. You're right. Because you got Dred Scott decision and what have you. But
you have the American Constitution, too. Not only Dred Scott decision.
Well, you got grandfather clauses and what have you. The idea of compensating the slave owner, this is one of Lincoln's theories, that you ought to compensate him, as I remember vaguely. This nauseates me.
It would probably have nauseated the Yankees on several counts. One, money. Two, and less importantly, moral revulsion.
Well, of course, on the other hand, I'm not so sure that money in and of itself would have appeased the southern plantation owner who was accustomed to services and serfdom.
How many plantation owners were there involved? How many? The figure is very small. If you had over 5 slaves.
Yeah.
You're dealing with a very small fractional society.
Even so, if you were only dealing with one man, it seems to me
it's morally wrong.
It does not justify paying a man for slaves, because I think this substantiates Dred Scott that this man is not.
Let me ask you another kind of question then. Right. Suppose by doing this, one might have avoided Reconstruction, segregation, and all the difficulties and degradations that have gone on for 100 years since. Suppose that this, by having a settlement, which the learned Swede proposes, too late, expropriated land paid for, a remuneration for emancipated slaves, and a general educational system is part of this, you see, and supervised education in terms of land handling and other educations for Negro and white. All this is one package. And Western migration. And also, I should have added, if I were called on, Northern migration training in crafts and industries, to head off some of the European immigration, which is exploited very brutally. Take this and train and protected immigration from the South.
Okay.
Let's take all this as a possibility. Let's take it as a possibility. Now, with the moral nausea have been too great a price to pay for peace by 1890?
Well,
and reasonably integrated society?
Well, because I think that this is purely speculative, number
it's all
one.
Oh, speculative.
Yeah.
I'm talking about pure emotions about this rather than anything else.
I would still have a great problem.
Even if you had peace by 1890 and a reasonable integration in the South, at least a humane relationship and a public education system working for Negroes and whites, you would still have an emotional problem about accepting this?
The emotional problem stems from the fact that I don't think that to pay for it would have done or reaped the thing that you are talking about by 1890.
Now listen, this isn't my question, sir. My question is, let's assume that his proposal would have been effective. Of course, it wouldn't have been possible to begin with that.
Right.
You can't turn Thaddeus Stevens loose in the world and have a settlement like this, you see. So we can say it wasn't possible, but it's not possible. Let's assume it would have been possible, and assume it had worked. You see that by 1890 or 1900, you'd have had a reasonably balanced society with some
justice. I still have a problem with it, yes.
You still have an emotional problem with it?
I think so, yes.
Emotional resistance to it.
That's right. I have to think about that a little more, but...
This question, I think, you can turn this around in many ways, and the emotional resistances would strike many a Yankee the same way. And you can reverse propositions like this and find the emotional resistances in Mississippi of a parallel order to a rational solution of things. See what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
That we all have emotional resistances, whether right or wrong.
I think it boils down to really asking the emotional question: is it peace at any price? Kind of question.
What was the price we have paid? We being all of us. Let's assume that Myrdal's program would have worked. It could have been accepted and could have worked. That by 1900. We've been over the hump. Is that too big a price to pay?
Well, I guess maybe not if you operate on the assumption that it's going to work.
That's part of my assumption.
Yeah.
That's the assumption.
But even so, I still have a great deal of problem with that.
I'd rather have it the way it is now. And no compensation for slaves or expropriated land. You'd rather have it the way it is.
I expect so, and that's kind of a hell of a thing to say.
Well, I mean, let's be honest.
I expect so.
Now look, let's turn this thing around.
All right.
You will take somebody in Mississippi right now who will pull down the temple. Do anything to maintain. I mean, to him it's purely an emotional attitude. It's totally irrational. Maintain segregation. It's against his interest. He knows that. It's against his interest. It's against his moral interest. He feels the moral disturbance. Yet he's committed to it in some people once more.
Why don't you ask that again? Why don't you rephrase?
All right. Now you, I must praise you as an honest man, and someday maybe you can praise me as well. But here's your chance. That you had rather have the actual settlement that occurred in Reconstruction, which meant no compensation for emancipated slaves to the Southern slave owner. With all the troubles that we have had then to now,
yeah.
And tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, too,
yeah.
Than to have had a Myrdal's proposal having been put into practice with compensation for slavery, compensation for expropriated land, and all the other things we talked about. But you bother that, the compensation.
This is
my little nausea.
This is my great problem. And maybe if I could get over that, I would have less problem with it. But I just have real problem because I think that there is some justification in the compensation for what happened, and I don't think that this can ever be justified on any basis.
Is the question whether slavery is a moral good the real question here or not?
Well,
is the question whether slavery is morally defensible or not? Is that the real question?
Well, I think that it is. There is no defense for slavery. There's no excuse.
Well, that's
there's no reason
now,
to be.
I'm not going to explain my reason asking the question.
Yeah.
Several years ago, a play of Euripides was done in the New York Theater, and an eminent theater critic wrote, "The Greeks are vastly overrated as playwrights. In fact, they held slaves." What about Greek slavery? Let's jump way back. Or Egyptian slavery. How do we feel about their slavery? Does this make Plato a fraud? Or Socrates a fake?
I think their real value to society, in terms of their real value to society, no. But I think that even so, it does not justify slavery in any stage of civilization.
What ends? How justification is a strange thing here. Knock slavery out?
I think we're
talking about slavery. We're not talking about the slavery of Negroes. We're talking about
slavery
of anybody.
Yeah.
Anybody.
Well, I think that historically, the thing that caused the dissipation of slavery was that it was economically unfeasible.
What made it economically unfeasible?
Well, here you are
the
with
machine.
Sure. That's what I was about to get to. Here you are with a bunch of people who, because of their ignorance, their inability to do only that which they have to do, that which they are told, they are robots in a sense.
A slave is a human machine. Yes.
Sure, that's right. Now, when you get something and do what that machine was doing, then the system, and I think that slavery, even in America, prior to the cotton gin, for example, had a deleterious effect on slavery, certainly, as you were getting...
If they had just invented the cotton gin,
things might have been different.
Things
might have been a little different. That's right.
Yeah, right.
That's right. And I think that automation, advances in technology and what have you, make the civil rights crisis extremely crucial at this very point.
What I'm driving at is this. I was horsing around. Is how a moral question is always historical perspective. It's conditioned by historical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm getting at there? And I don't have any bill of goods to sell about this. It's just something that's awfully hard to say. The Greeks shouldn't have held slaves. They were bad.
Well, this is where you get into, you talk about justification. This is where you get into it.
I don't know what to say about it. He says here,
yeah.
here is the whole problem of historical perspective. Let's take something else. Or if I read you this little passage, this is sort of a nasty way of doing things, reading little passages, so let's talk about that. But I don't have a way to, engage certain questions. I have some beautiful quotes from Lincoln, which you probably know. I will say that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black race. And I won't go on with the rest of these quotations.
Yeah, I've seen it.
The whole stacks, I'm just saying.
Sure.
The most interesting one is given after the Emancipation Proclamation to a group of free Negroes who called in the White House to thank Mr. Lincoln, the President.
Yeah. Well,
how does this affect you?
Well, number one, I believe about Lincoln that Lincoln was not necessarily a great advocate, as is indicated in your statement, of Negro equality and Negro rights. I think that Lincoln primarily acted to save the Union. And this was his real value. Now, to me, as Negro 100 years later, I'm not interested in the whys and the wherefores of what Lincoln did. Because, you see, the only thing that I can see 100 years later is that Lincoln signed the Freedom Paper. His name is on it. And insofar as I'm concerned, this is his only value.
It's symbolic value, not a personal value.
That's right. That's right. He put his name on the paper. And this, to me, is a great triumph.
What do you think of Robert E. Lee? Let's just sort of throw these things around a little bit. What about Robert E. Lee in this connection?
Well, I think Robert E. Lee has a reputation, and as I think about him, of being a Southern gentleman. He took defeat.
He was an emancipationist. He had slaves and emancipated them very
yeah.
early because he didn't think slavery was evil.
Yeah. But by the same token, his loyalty to his native Virginia,
now,
what have you.
Now, his loyalty to what now? His loyalty to what? What is this nature of his loyalty?
He's
a thoroughgoing emancipationist. He hated slavery, and Lincoln did much more. Lincoln clearly horsed around for years and years about it.
Sure.
Lee just said it cost me money, but, you know, I can't participate in this.
Yeah.
You stuck with the great participation.
Yeah.
Grant held slaves until after the Civil War.
Yeah. I'm not sure that Lee could have fought against the people from the South, even though what I'm trying to say is that the cause of the South for Lee might have been greater than the cause of Lee. I just don't know. I just see Robert E. Lee as he's depicted pretty much in the Southern high school history books.
Let's forget those.
Yeah, well, all right.
We're not talking that level.
Yeah. Well, the only significance that I can attach to Lee is that after defeat, he was a gentleman. And as you indicated, he was an emancipationist and that he freed his slaves and this kind of thing.
What was he loyal to? Can we not that anybody knows necessarily, but
yeah.
What was he being loyal to here? And how would you evaluate this loyalty?
Well, I think it's really kind of a regional loyalty. That the South was more important to him than the Union. And maybe for some reason or other, he did not see slavery as the key issue
like
in
Lincoln.
The Civil War,
like
as
Lincoln
did. That's right.
Lincoln did not see
that's right.
The
and this is not to say that I know what he envisioned as the key issue, but if you move from the premise that it was that he, you know, did not believe in slavery, then he saw something more important in the Civil War. Maybe he felt that maybe it was economic where the South was concerned, or something like that. I'm just not certain.
I don't know that anybody is certain. I guess my point behind all of this is that the world has changed very decisively, hasn't it? Issues seem clearer to us now than they did. Can we judge the past in terms of our present vision of issues?
Well, I think not. I think that the past must, you must look at Lee acting in 1965, or acting between 1960 and 1965.
What would he do now? What would he do now
well,
in 1965?
I suspected Lee in 1964 would be a Terry Sanford of North Carolina.
You think so? I get probably wrong with the Southern Regional Council.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And I think this largely depends whether Lee was a politician.
He was not to be a politician.
or whether or not he was a successful lawyer as a part of a big firm or successful businessman. But I think that you are absolutely right, that Lee very probably would have been on the board or executive committee of Southern Regional Council. Had he lived, assuming that he was living now, but I think that you have to look at Lee in his time.
It's a very hard thing to do imaginatively, isn't it, without reading these things and making them sort of labels for our time projected backward. And then the reason I'm hammering at this in a rather unpleasant way, I guess, is because these things seem to have some reference to the way we behave now.
Well,
this is the end of take 3 of a conversation with Vernon Jordan.